Welcome to WMKV Health Scope, a weekly discussion of health and wellness issues for older adults, their families, and caregivers. This call-in program is presented by 89.3 WMKV. To have your medical-related question concerning today's topic answered live on the air, call 513-772-9658. That's 772-WMKV. And now, WMKV Health Scope. We welcome you to Health Scope here on 89.3 FM WMKV, now also on 89.9 FM WLHS, serving Butler and Warren counties as well. We are going to be talking about today a program we haven't done in quite a while, and that is women's reproductive health. We have a very special guest here with us, Dr. Ian Foley. He is with OBGYN Associates. He also does surgeries at Westchester Hospital in addition to other hospitals around the greater Cincinnati area. He has a private practice in Fairfield, Ohio, my neck of the woods. That's great. And again, that's OBGYN Associates. And also, we want to thank very much UC Westchester and the hospital there at UC Health for helping to line up Dr. Foley. Dr. Foley, thank you for coming in with us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Let's talk for just a moment a little bit about how you came to this field of medicine. What drew you to gynecology?
Well, it was a bit of a process. I started medical school and knew I wanted to do a surgical specialty, but during the different rotations you do through medical school, I came to really enjoy the primary care aspect, and it's a great pleasure delivering babies. So OBGYN, it has all the specialties in it that appeal to me. Continuity of care, I'll get to see a woman throughout the entire course of her life and take care of her through all the different events and challenges and births that can come. And also get to do surgeries, which I do enjoy.
And I have to say, as a father, and my wife and I both shared a special bond with the obstetrician who delivered our daughter 23 years ago. It is an amazing feeling from our standpoint because you're putting your trust into the hands of this professional. And as a professional, does it ever get old?
No, it doesn't get old. The one problem with when you deliver babies, if you start delivering babies that you delivered, you know, if you start delivering children of the babies you delivered, you start to realize maybe it's time to move south.
I was going to say, you probably got a little time, though, before that happens yet. But if you're just joining us here on HealthScope, Dr. Ian Foley is our special guest. We're talking about women's reproductive health. And also, thank you to Jen Garcia for being here today with us as well. Let's talk for a little bit about the different gynecologic issues that women face in different stages of life. I have a 23-year-old daughter who's had her own issues gynecologically. And from the standpoint, though, I think most people think, well, the real concerns are later in life for many women. But it can happen. You can have issues at any point, can you not?
Oh, yes, of course. And during adolescence, the most common issues that come up are when young women start having their menstrual cycles. They can have heavy bleeding or a lot of pain associated with it, and it does cause problems if they can't go to school or just enjoy the normal activities that teenagers do. And those are easily treated, but, you know, sometimes there are some barriers in terms of having, you know, a relationship with your parents or a caregiver, just being willing to speak up at that age and say this is a problem. That can be a hindrance to getting care. But those are the common issues. And then, of course, the other thing is, and it's difficult as a father myself to just even begin talking about birth control for a teenager, but unintended pregnancy in adolescence can be a significant problem. So being able to have an open conversation about birth control and treatment of periods would be a very common issue that is seen with adolescent women.
And that is such a great point. It comes back to communication. And for the young person in your life, knowing that there's someone who can, that they can talk to non-judgmentally or whatever, somebody who that they know has been through maybe some of this before when it comes to the menstruation, or again, somebody that they can feel confident in talking to who is setting a good example as far as early pregnancy and knowing what to do and what not to do and taking the right precautions if there is going to be that situation.
Yes, it's, you know, every family is different, every life
sure.
is different.
Exactly.
And where we find our role models and people we can confide in, it varies from person to person. You know, the other thing that... For adolescent women, just because they come in with an issue or need birth control, it doesn't mean that they're going to have a pelvic exam necessarily. And I know that when younger women come in, they're very nervous about having that done. So, you know, it's just important to get them in the door and begin having a conversation about whatever it is that they need to talk about.
Really, at roughly what age would it be ideal for a young woman to have their first pelvic exam?
Well, really, not unless there's a significant issue. And then after that, just kind of the general rules in terms of when you're going to have to do a pelvic exam. Pap smears don't start until the age of 21 now. Mm-hmm. And then sexually transmitted disease testing would be something you want to do once a woman does become sexually active at whatever age that would be.
Certainly. And once again, when they have this, I think it's important too that when it is time to have the first pelvic exam, even though there may not be any indication of any problems or anything, it gives you as the OBGYN really an opportunity to have a baseline to know what, you know, what the pelvic region, what the reproductive area is like.
Well, yes, you know, and every woman's different in terms of their pelvic anatomy. But, you know, really the important thing is the symptoms that bring them in. Most of the heavy bleeding issues, you can do some blood work to rule out certain chronic diseases or inheritable diseases. And then really it's just a matter of their sexual activity in terms of needing a pelvic exam or not.
Very good. We have Dr. Ian Foley here with us talking about women's reproductive health. He is with OBGYN Associates in Fairfield, as well as doing surgeries at Westchester Hospital with part of UC Health here as well. And we're talking about different gynecologic issues that women face at different stages of life. We've covered some of the early life issues. As women age, are there some other gynecologic issues that can come into play here?
Well, then once women reach the age of 21, they'll need to have a pap smear. And with the newer recommendations, they don't need a pap smear every year. What we've found over the past 5 to 10 years mm-hmm. is that if a woman does not have the HPV virus, the high-risk types, then they don't need to have a pap smear every year. It's really the HPV virus that causes cervical cancer and all the abnormal paps that we see and follow.
So when we come back to this, then the pap smear is that the primary reason that the pap smear is run for this virus?
Well, no, the pap smear is sampling cells from the cervix mm-hmm. and looks at those cells to see if there are any abnormalities. Then along with looking at those cells, we also test for the HPV virus.
Gotcha.
So, without the HPV virus, there really is little risk of developing cervical cancer. Now, with abnormal cells, those need to be evaluated separately. The way that we would evaluate an abnormal pap smear is to do something called a colposcopy, and that is where we look at the cervix through a microscope, essentially, to get a very close and detailed view. And then if we see any abnormalities on the colposcopy, we can do a small biopsy. And then with that tissue, we can tell if there's an abnormality there that's significant or not.
What are some of the abnormalities you might be looking for there? Would there be like bumps or irregularities?
Well, the reason to do the biopsy is to see if there's any cancer or precancerous
Certainly.
Lesion that could then be managed separately. As far as the atypical findings that you would see on a colposcopy, sometimes you can see abnormal vessels on the cervix that could indicate abnormal tissue underneath or precancerous. Sometimes if you see thickening of the cervical tissue, that can also indicate that there is a precancerous lesion underlying that. And then by doing the biopsy, the pathologist has a piece of tissue to look at and see if there is something abnormal. Now, as far as if there is an abnormality, the next step would be getting a bigger piece of tissue, either something called a LEAP, and that's where we use an electrode and take a small portion of the cervix off. Or if it's a more significant lesion, we can do something called a cold knife cone, and that's done in the OR with anesthesia, and we take a very big portion of the cervix out. And those are really reserved for significant precancerous or the other term is pre-invasive cancer of the cervix.
Very good. And I think let's go back to just the general scope for a moment where you're just taking a look. I think there may be women out there who've never had to have this done before and wondering about, you know, what kind of discomfort, what kind of preparation is done to do something like this. What can they expect if they have find themselves where they just need to have the scope done?
Well, yeah, so doing the colposcopy is not the uncomfortable part with the colposcopy is that the speculum has to be in the vagina for, you know, 2 or 3 minutes as we take a close look.
Certainly.
And that's what causes most of the discomfort. In order to help visualize the cervix and the tissue better, we use acetic acid or essentially vinegar, and we put that on the cervix. And that what that does is it dries the first layer of cells and then allows us to kind of see underneath that first layer. So really the discomfort is just from having a prolonged examination. And then if a biopsy is done, it's a small pinch and there's some discomfort, but it's very well tolerated.
Very good. Dr. Ian Foley, our special guest here on HealthScope. By the way, if you have a question, would like to join the conversation today, the number is 513-772-9658. Our toll-free number as well, 877-772-9658, as we're talking about women's reproductive and health issues. Okay, as we get into the later stages, it seems to me that I'm hearing more and more about women who are maybe 15, 20 years ago would never have thought to have a pregnancy later in life or having them later and later. I guess my question is, does a biological clock now have a snooze alarm? Are there things that women need to be concerned about when they get to a certain age about childbearing?
Well, I don't know if there's a snooze alarm.
Okay.
Necessarily. The biological clock is still essentially the same. Now, where we've made big improvements are in the assisted reproductive technologies. So as women get older, there are many drugs and interventions that can be done that can help them get pregnant. But they would still face the same risks as a woman who was 45 if she was able to get pregnant 30 years ago that they would face now. The common issues that happen just in terms of once a woman is pregnant over the age of 35 is there's an increased risk of Down syndrome or other chromosomal abnormalities. There is now, the term is non-invasive testing that we can do for these chromosomal abnormalities, and it's a simple blood draw. And with that blood draw, we're able to see if there is fetal DNA in the mother's bloodstream, and then that can then be amplified to determine if there is a baby with Down syndrome or some other chromosomal issues.
Certainly.
Previously, a woman would have to have a procedure called an amniocentesis, and that's where a needle is stuck through the abdomen into the uterus, and then we would draw fluid from around the baby. And then we would look at that fluid to see if there were any abnormalities. So in terms of managing women as they get older in their pregnancy, we do have less invasive management for complications that could develop.
And also, I would imagine, just as the body ages, I mean, you know, we feel it in our knees as we get older. We feel it in other parts of our body as we get older. Being in the best possible health for that pregnancy is probably a very important factor as well. Does the body, does the uterus age, or does the age of the uterus really have any effect on how the baby is actually born?
Well, the age of the uterus isn't necessarily the issue. Mm-hmm. What we see is women get older, and it's a very difficult thing to tell a 36-year-old woman that she is advanced maternal age or elderly. I almost get slapped on a regular basis with that one.
You mean elderly as far as maternal age, right?
Yeah, maternal age.
Right. They're not ready for the AARP card yet. Right?
Exactly. Right. We're going to have to work on a better term. But once a woman turns 35, then that is considered advanced maternal age. And that is when the risk of Down syndrome is increased. Now, some of the other issues that you will see, and it's not, again, it's not necessarily uterine age, but just maternal age, increased risk of having high blood pressure in pregnancy, increased risk of gestational diabetes in pregnancy. And then there can be some abnormalities in the placenta that can impact the fetal growth and the fluid around the fetus. So when a woman turns 35, the way to manage that pregnancy is with more frequent ultrasounds to monitor the growth of the baby. And then once she gets to 32 weeks gestation, then you'd start seeing her every week and doing an ultrasound to measure the fluid around the baby.
It's always very important. And again, having those regular trips, I would imagine no matter whether you're a mother, an expectant mother in your 20s, all the way up to, quote unquote, the elderly age,
right,
or having that regular visit with your OBGYN is so, so important. But even more important, it sounds like, especially as the pregnancy advances for someone who is in the latter section there.
Well, yes, the important part is to monitor the growth of the baby and then the fluid around the baby as well and the overall fetal health, because in the other benefit in today's world is that the outcomes for babies born earlier is much better than it would have been 20 years or 25 years ago. So to deliver a baby at 34 weeks now, those babies do very well. Now, if we're not able to monitor the mother and she's not coming in or we're not getting the ultrasounds done, then yes, those babies could turn out worse.
Right, right. And again, regular care is one of the most important things. Does it help? It seems to me a brilliant grasp of the obvious, but I feel like I have to ask this. The overall general health of the mother, I don't care what the age, it definitely will increase, would you say, the chance of having a good, healthy pregnancy?
Oh, yes. I don't think you can put state it any stronger, but if a mother is healthy when she starts the pregnancy, then the pregnancy is going to be a lot easier. You know, the common complaints, just non-obstetrical, is back pain and hip pain and just feeling tired and run down. And when women are healthy before they get pregnant, then a lot of those symptoms are much less than before.
Very good. We have Dr. Ian Foley here with us on behalf of Westchester Hospital, UC Health, and also OBGYN Associates in Fairfield. We have our first caller of the program. Let's check in with Will. By the way, if you'd like to join the conversation, 713-772-9658. Boy, I'll be okay. 513-772-9658 or 877-772-9658, our toll-free number. Let's go to Will. Will, thank you for holding on. You're on with Dr. Ian Foley.
Hi, how are you? Hey, I'm actually a family doc also in Sharonville. And a question that might be very hard to talk about, but as you're talking about mature women who have multiple potential complications and with pregnancies and outcomes, if you will, and as a family physician, seeing, you know, older women as well, who get pregnant and don't want to be pregnant. I mean, here's the elephant in the room. It's a surprise, and oh my gosh, what can they do and what can we do, if you will, because it's a very touchy subject and very, very difficult. Didn't know if you had any strategies with the university or others, because I know politically it's a lightning rod.
Yes, it is. But yeah, that's, I mean, obviously, I'm sure that every obstetrician or gynecologist has run into this at some point or another, at least those seasoned enough to have had numerous people. Mm-hmm. And that is a difficult conversation to have.
Yeah, and I think the way that I've gone about it is I just try to be open with the women in terms of what their different what the different options are. You know, in our office, we don't offer termination, so they'd have to go to either wherever, the Women's Health Center or a Planned Parenthood. But in terms of taking care of the pregnancy from that point forward, right, you know, just begin with the routine, right, stuff in terms of prenatal vitamins, and then the other thing is the early testing for any of the genetic abnormalities. That way they can have even more information in terms of what they want to do. The non-invasive testing, you can do at 10 weeks, so they can know pretty early if this is going to be, if there is going to be a chromosomal issue that would help them make a decision.
Well, and that's actually what I bring it up. It is hard. I mean, in docs, we talk with patients about many different, very sensitive issues and difficult issues, and it is. It can be horrifying many times for elderly, I don't know what the term was you said, not necessarily elderly women, but older women from a fertility perspective.
Yes.
Who don't want to be pregnant because of all these risks. And so I'm just wondering, you know, and it's tough. Therapeutic abortion, if you will, is a very tough one to, and unfortunately they might shut down any access to that, frankly, in southwestern Ohio pretty soon if something's not done to address that issue and or even worse, rape victims. So I just thought I'd bring it up because it's a discussion that nobody likes to talk about. And it's supercharged politically, but physicians face it all the time. And elderly women are sort of victims of this if we don't appropriately have access to safe care for women. So I think that's the issue.
Sure. Will, I thank you for the call on that. And it is a topic that definitely bears more discussion. One of the things that I appreciate, I think, about our radio station is we try to present ideas and then let people make their own decisions rather than preaching to people and trying to tell them how to do this. I do have a quick question, though, as a family doctor, and then we have Dr. Foley here who is a specialist. How important is it to have good communication between family doctors or the primary care physician in many cases and the obstetrician, gynecologist, either feeling from either one of you while I have you both here?
Oh, well, I mean, the family physician has a much broader understanding and knowledge base for most of the common conditions that come up. And you know, I'm limited to just obstetrical and gynecologic issues. So I lean heavily on the family physicians and the general practitioners who send us patients, just in terms of pre-op evaluations to just taking care of a cough and cold. I mean, it's invaluable to have that good communication.
Will, what about your perspective?
I would echo that as well. And it's of interest. I've been doing practice for 28 years now, and I would say it's extremely important. And what I know, I've seen a lot of OBGYNs or OB docs particularly, they're so busy now because of some of the pressures that are going on, and the communication is less and less. And so we have a whole development of what's called the electronic medical record that we think is helping communicate, but many times it's not. So for managing medical conditions in the pregnant female, it can be not as easy as it should be, but I think if we all start talking about it and make it, it could get better, but that's critical. I would agree with you.
Very good.
I've found that the telephone works far better than electronic medical records.
Thank you for saying that. I totally agree with you.
Thank you. Well, we've two doctors surveyed, two doctors approved right now on
it's a
that.
Miracle.
Thank you. Will, thank you for your call today. Thought-provoking, and thank you very much for being part of our conversation here today.
Yeah, thank you for doing it.
Thank you so much. 513-772-9658 is our number, or 877-772-9658. Coming back to the young woman who is maybe having that first menstrual period, things like that, it may not be the OBGYN who is the first communication with this. It could be that they're going to their family doctor, and the mom or the dad is saying, you know, how do we talk to them about this or whatever? So, quite often it may be that family doc on the first line here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oftentimes it's a pediatrician that they'll see, or their family physician. Mm-hmm. Typically what will happen is the mother has a gynecologist, and she brings her daughter to her gynecologist, has been my experience. So,
exactly.
So having that good relationship with a patient really helps to bring the whole family along.
We have Dr. Ian Foley here on WMKV and WLHL and HealthScope. Dr. Ian Foley, our special guest, as we talk about women's reproductive health. And we have Harold, who's on the line. We've had all guys calling today. We're doing a women's health show, and we have all guys calling today. But, Harold, you're welcome to join us here in the conversation with Dr. Ian Foley.
Hey, nice job, Dr. Foley. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, my wife and I got married at a later state of our life. We're both now 45 and would like to start a family. She's very concerned for, you know, the obvious reasons, Down syndrome, autism, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm willing to roll the dice on this. What should I tell her? I mean, is there other facts that you could give me that maybe sway her to having children?
Well,
oh, that's a good question. Boy, that, talk about rolling the dice. That's a loaded dice right there.
Yeah, it sure is. Yeah, at the age of 45, it's going to be very difficult to have a spontaneous conception. So I would say the best thing to do is talk to a reproductive endocrinologist, because they'll be able to offer up more invasive treatment in order to help her get pregnant. Now, as far as the issues with Down syndrome and the other genetic diseases, the risk is going to be very high in terms of having a baby with Down syndrome or any other chromosomal abnormality. And then maintaining a pregnancy at the age of 45 to term is an exceedingly rare event. But certainly if you both want to try and are ready to accept some of the risks that come with it, then I would encourage you to see a reproductive endocrinologist to help you with that.
I appreciate that. Thank you. This has been an excellent, excellent discussion. So I appreciate your time, Dr. Foley.
Thank you, Harold.
Thank you, Harold, very much for that call. We need to take a quick break here on HealthScope. Cheryl, please hold on. We'll have you on in the second half of the show in just a moment or two. We have Dr. Ian Foley here with us, obstetrician and gynecologist. We're talking about women's reproductive health. A big thank you going out to UC Health. They're at uchealth.com/Westchester Hospital. You can find out more about doctors such as Dr. Foley and the other doctors there at 513-298-DOCS, D-O-C-S. Also, Dr. Foley has his own independent practice in the Fairfield area. They're at CincyOBGYN.com. That's Cincy with a Y. And also their number, 513-221-3800. We'll give more information at the end of the show. If you'd like to join the conversation today on women's reproductive health, open lines right now at 513-772-9658. We'll be back in just a moment. The views and discussion expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of the hosts of the program or of WMKV Radio, Maple Knoll Communities, WLHS, the Lakota Local School District, or its staff and management. Discussion of specific points and general topics on this program are not meant to be taken as specific professional advice. And we welcome you back to HealthScope here on WMKV and WLHS. We're talking with Dr. Ian Foley about women's reproductive health. We've talked about some of the different challenges at different ages within a woman's life. We've learned about being quote-unquote elderly from a maternal standpoint, and that doesn't mean elderly as an elderly. So I don't want to get Dr. Foley or me in any trouble here, because we deal with a lot of seniors and things like that. But again, it is something just very insightful call so far today. And we have another caller on the line. We're going to Cheryl calling now. Cheryl, thank you for holding on. You're on with Dr. Ian Foley.
Thank you. Dr. Foley, I'm a mother of three young girls, and I've been hearing a lot about the HPV vaccine. Can you tell me about it, and do you recommend girls getting the vaccine?
Yes, I think that's a very good idea, and it sometimes can be a little bit of a loaded question, because there's a thought out there that perhaps if you give a young woman the HPV vaccine, that somehow that'll encourage earlier sexual activity, but there have been a lot of studies that have shown that simply isn't true. Also, the benefit of the HPV vaccine is clearly a decrease in the rate of cervical cancer and even abnormal pap smears. Women in their 20s and 30s sometimes can be coming in every 6 months to have pap smears if they have an abnormality, but by getting the HPV vaccine, that will decrease abnormal pap smears and decrease the number of follow-up visits that they would need.
Great. Do we need to get that through our pediatrician, or is it something that I need to go to an OB?
Well, most pediatricians will offer that, since you do want to have your daughters and young women get the HPV vaccine before they're sexually active. So the age would be sometime around 11, 12, something like that. So most pediatricians will offer it, but we do have it in our office and are happy to provide that.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. Cheryl, from the standpoint of family, communication's a big deal. Do you feel pretty comfortable as these young women age that you're ready to communicate with them about all this?
No.
Okay.
Times are different, and I remember when I was little, you didn't really talk about it, and now it's something that needs to be brought up pretty early in life, and you know, you look at your girls and you still think that they're babies, but they're learning stuff at school and on the bus that, you know, we just need to, I guess, buck up and just have that conversation with them, or multiple conversations, just to get the lines of communication open.
Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing that thought as well today. Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Thanks, Cheryl. 772-9658 or 877-772-9658 to speak with Dr. Ian Foley today about women's reproductive health. And we've talked about pretty much the spectrum age-wise of women and some of the things that they challenge, or some of the challenges that they face. Have we left any of those off before we move on to maybe just centering a little bit more in on middle-aged women?
Well, you know, the one thing that we didn't touch on is some testing that can be done before women get pregnant. There are certain genetic diseases that can be inherited that can be very devastating for the child. One of those is spinal muscular atrophy. And basically, 1 in 50 people are a carrier for that particular disease. And so when you have two parents who are carriers, they wouldn't know that they have it. And most of the time, there's no family history that demonstrates that they have it. They would then have a 1 in 4 chance of having a child with spinal muscular atrophy. So getting testing for that before getting pregnant can be very helpful in terms of planning. Also, cystic fibrosis is another disease that you can have. The mother can have testing to see if she's a carrier. And having some of those tests done before getting pregnant can be helpful, just in terms of planning and fully understanding an individual's risk of having a baby that's affected by those diseases.
Do you ever feel almost an awe at what we can now test for and what we can know leading into a pregnancy versus maybe when you were just starting your practice or just starting your study?
Well, it certainly has expanded very rapidly, just being able to test maternal blood for fetal cells in it and to have a very good understanding of what the risk for that particular child is impressive. I think what is more awe-inspiring is what can be done in the future and, mm-hmm. and what kind of testing we'll be able to do in the future. And it's exciting to be a part of it.
And also, it's mind-boggling to me to think about the strides that we've made in overall medicine to increase people's vitality and their longevity. And of course, if you don't keep the vitality, increasing the longevity doesn't help too much. But it's one of those things that it's really, really important, and to see how people can recover and do things and even pull off some of these higher risk pregnancies at times. But again, it's important, as I think that was a wonderful comment that you made, though, to Harold about having to be aware of the risks and having intelligent and in-depth conversations with people before you move forward on an older person having a pregnancy. It's very important.
And I think that's the other benefit of, even if you don't need to have a pap smear every year, but to come in to, especially for a woman in her 20s and 30s, to come in every year just to have the physical exam part, but also to have that time and opportunity to have a conversation about what your reproductive plans are and what your family plans are. And that really, that allows us to have the conversation and do whatever testing or intervention or whatever would be indicated.
And again, going to a specialist is a great way to find out the most in-depth things. It's great maybe to start with your family doc or your primary care, but then there comes a point for many of those doctors where they're going to say, look, you need to talk to the specialist about all the options that are there. Let's talk about another one that can be a very, I would think, a heartbreaking choice for a woman, but let's talk about the hysterectomy. What are the conditions? What are the different symptoms that might have a woman considering a hysterectomy?
Well, certainly a hysterectomy, that is a very big decision. It's a major surgery. I believe there was a CDC report in the last year or so that says about 1 in 3 women would have a hysterectomy in their lifetime or by the age of 60,
I think, yeah.
I think that number, we will see that decrease over time. One of the major, most common reasons to get a hysterectomy would be abnormal bleeding. And as less invasive procedures are developed to help treat that, then the hysterectomy rate will further decrease. One particular procedure that's very successful is an ablation, and that's essentially where we destroy the lining of the uterus, and that's either done in the office or in the hospital. And that can significantly decrease bleeding and can also stop the bleeding entirely. Some of the other issues that would come up for the need for a hysterectomy would be pain, large fibroids, if there's organ prolapse, so if the uterus and bladder and rectum, if they're prolapsing through the vagina, that could require surgery. And then we touched on a little bit earlier, but if you were to have cancer of the reproductive tract, then a hysterectomy along with more significant surgery would be required.
And there are different types of procedures, I guess, for a hysterectomy?
Yes. So the most common one that's performed is the abdominal hysterectomy, and that is where an incision is made in the abdomen, and then the uterus and ovaries, if it's indicated, are removed through the abdomen. That is decreasing in the number that has been being done. Another procedure is the vaginal hysterectomy, and that's all done through the vagina. The uterus is removed from its attachments and pulled through the vagina, and then everything is sewn up. Then there's also a laparoscopic hysterectomy, and that's where small incisions are made in the abdomen, and putting instruments through there, the uterus is then removed and everything is sewn back up. And then just in terms of another kind of subcategory is when the hysterectomy is done laparoscopically, sometimes the cervix is left, and that is called a supracervical hysterectomy. So those would be the different types of hysterectomies that could be done.
Are there specific instances or conditions under which one might be better than the other?
Well, the vaginal hysterectomy has been shown to be less painful than or less pain postoperatively and a faster return to function than an abdominal hysterectomy. When you compare laparoscopic hysterectomy with a vaginal hysterectomy, laparoscopic surgery has even less postoperative pain and a faster return to normal activity.
We'll come back. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't want to interrupt you there.
Well, just in terms of overall decision-making on which hysterectomy to have, it really comes down to how big the uterus is and the comfort of the individual surgeon with the different methods. You certainly wouldn't want somebody to do a procedure that they're not comfortable with or experienced with just because of some perceived benefit. You want to do what you're going to be comfortable with as a patient and what the surgeon is comfortable with as the surgeon.
And we'll be going back to Philippe on the phone here in just a moment, but are there non-surgical options available to a hysterectomy?
Yeah, we talked a little bit about the ablation earlier, and that would be good option for heavy bleeding. Now, with fibroids, there's a procedure called a uterine artery embolization, and that is where a catheter is put in through one of the femoral arteries, and then this catheter is then fed up to the uterine artery. And injecting some material into that vessel, it'll cut off blood flow to the uterus. And that's very helpful for very, very big fibroids in a woman who would not tolerate surgery well with some other comorbid conditions, significant heart disease or lung disease or something that would preclude her from having surgery. So that would be a non-invasive option for women who really just couldn't tolerate surgery.
Our very special guest here is Dr. Ian Foley. We're talking about women's reproductive health. He is with OBGYN Associates in Fairfield. They're at CincyOBGYN.com. That's Cincy with a Y. Also, thanks to UC Health for helping to line up Dr. Foley for us today. He does surgeries at UC Westchester, uchealth.com/Westchester Hospital. Let's go to Philippe, who's been waiting patiently on the line. Philippe, thank you so much for holding on. You're on with Dr. Ian Foley.
Hi, doctor. I'm a single dad, and I have an 11-year-old daughter who says she'd like to go onto a birth control pill, and I'm very hesitant because I think it's going to be used for sexual activity. She says it's for cramping. How do I go about dealing with this? She does not have a mother in her life, so I'm the one who has to deal with this, and it's a touchy situation. What would you recommend or how I go about this?
Well, it is certainly a very touchy situation, and 11 is very young to have started her menstrual cycles like that. There are non-birth control options. Sometimes just taking Motrin or Aleve a few days before a period starts, that can help decrease the bleeding and the pain. I think having her at age 11 with periods, that would be someone that would benefit from seeing her pediatrician just to evaluate for some other issues that may be there for periods that young. But certainly deciding to use birth control pills, I tend to describe them as hormone control pills for women that young, but certainly that's a family decision that can be very difficult.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Philippe. Thank you for your call today. And again, this comes back to an area of communication in an area where, as Cheryl pointed out, years ago, it was one of those things that you really didn't always want to talk about. I would imagine the dynamic of a single father with a daughter can be even a little bit more stressful at times.
Yes.
And so I, Philippe, as two gentlemen sitting here, I think we can feel some of that pain that you're feeling there right now. And I have a 23-year-old, but I was lucky to have my wife there to be with her during some of those very difficult times when she didn't want to talk to dad.
Mm-hmm.
And again, maybe finding the healthcare professional might even be able to help break a little bit of the ice as far as discussing this a little bit more. You never know. Not putting all the pressure on the OBGYN or the family doctor in that case. But sometimes I would imagine there have been times where you've been able to kind of maybe bridge the gap.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's more a matter of just trying to facilitate a conversation in terms of what, again, what the options are and what needs to be done to have a diagnosis. So, mm-hmm. So yes, in those instances with a young woman and trying to figure out if it, you know, treatment for that kind of pain,
yeah.
it does get difficult because all the treatments are labeled birth control, and certainly that does carry a connotation with it.
And also, it's a kind of a trust but verify type thing as well. You want to make sure that that symptom is actually there, mm-hmm. and that it's not Philippe's worst concern. So it's something, you know, it's a very sticky wicket, if you will. We have Dr. Ian Foley here with us. He's an obstetrician and gynecologist with OBGYN Associates. We're going to Pam here on line one. Pam, thank you for holding on. You're on with Dr. Ian Foley.
Sure, George. I just wanted to make a real quick couple comments. My first was, I was born and raised in Florida. And I started when I was 10 and a half, which I'm told in the tropical climes is more possible or probable even. But 10 and a half, I did have my first menstrual cycle. And I did have some cramps. And I was pretty bad, probably not as bad as some, but... I was given some medications, and some of them, in fact, there's one I think now, it was probably, and that was like 55 years ago. It was some sort of a, I believe it must have had one of the Dexedrine or one of the, anyway, I'd stop cramping and I'd want to go plan a party. I mean, it was. but I'm going to think back later. My God, you know. But it is, you know, communication is important. And my mother's comment was that she started when she was 13 and she'd been washing walls all day. And her mother just looked at her and said, well, put a napkin on. And she said, I'll never wash walls again because nice girls don't do that.
Very good. The other thing it reminds me of was when I was a kid, there was the kind of the gag about the tampons or whatever. And this little girl said, I can't wait to get my first package of tampons because according to those commercials, you get to ride bikes and you get to run and do all kinds of fun things. And it, you know, somehow they equated that it, you know,
right.
Yeah, you know where I'm going with that. So anyway,
yeah.
But well, Pam, thank you for the input today. And that's the first time I've heard that maybe different climates or different areas or regions can actually bring on that maturation a little bit earlier.
I've read something about that years ago. Now, maybe it's been refuted, but the constant exposure to light was supposedly a factor, which is interesting because I actually do not see any light because I happen to be blind, but possibly just the exposure. I don't know, but this is what I heard. And very quickly, I have a cousin who adopted a child who was number five in a family where they could not afford another baby, and mother didn't want to terminate. And so this young lady who did have ADD, there was some other issues, some physical abuse I won't go into, but this young lady is now, I think, 20, and she is a sophomore in college. She's doing beautifully. So adoption on either end of the spectrum, if you find yourself in a situation you don't want to be, you can consider adoption. If you cannot have a child, you can consider adoption.
Very good. That's
Thank
a great
you.
Point. Thank you, Pam.
Sure, bye-bye.
Thank you. And another option yet for the mid-40s couples who may not want to take all that risk.
Yes, and that that is, you know, one of the things that we do talk about when women come in either seeking pregnancy or having an unexpected one.
Very good. We have Dr. Ian Foley here with us for just a few more minutes. I did want to ask, coming back to the hysterectomy for a moment, I think for the concern of a lot of women when they have a hysterectomy, they wonder about, will I really have any kind of a sex life or a sex drive after a hysterectomy? What's your take on this?
Well, there have been many studies where they look at both sex drive after a hysterectomy and looking at a total hysterectomy where the cervix is removed and comparing that with a supracervical hysterectomy where the cervix remains. And there hasn't been shown any difference in sex drive or in sexual function. So the take-home message is that once a hysterectomy is performed, there really isn't a change in sex drive or sexual performance or satisfaction between those two methods. Really what happens is a woman has the hysterectomy because she either has heavy bleeding or she has pain or fibroids or something that's really impacting her life and causing her to be tired and worn out or having pain. And so once you remove that, issue, then all other aspects of her life begin to improve. She's able to enjoy whatever activity it was she couldn't do before and be a part of her family in a way that she wasn't when she'd be bleeding heavily for 5 days or have pain for 2 weeks out of the month or whatever the issue is. So really, once you remove that source of pain or bleeding or whatever the issue is, then all the other assets and facets of her life have improve.
I have a young daughter who actually battled something called pelvic congestion, coming back to this. And can you explain what pelvic congestion is? What happens when somebody encounters this? Mm-hmm. I can tell just from firsthand from my daughter's description, it's incredibly painful. Literally, you feel like you're doubled over in pain. I've heard comparisons to the pain of like appendicitis or something like that. What is pelvic congestion?
Well, there's a lot of blood flow to the pelvis. There are the uterine arteries, and they supply blood to the uterus and the cervix. Then the ovaries actually get their blood supply essentially from the same vessels that go to the kidneys, and that's mm-hmm. just how the ovaries develop. So that blood supply is a little bit different. And then there's some other vessels that flow in there as well that are kind of secondary in terms of how much blood they supply. But what happens is there's a slow return of that blood back to the vena cava that then takes the blood back to the heart. And having that slower return, you begin to have distension of those vessels and you begin to have some engorgement of some of the tissue in the pelvis mm-hmm. that can cause a lot of pain. The more significant issue with pelvic congestion syndrome is that it's difficult to diagnose because a woman will come in with pain and you really don't see anything necessarily on ultrasound. In the exam, they're uncomfortable. So it's a diagnosis of exclusion, and usually when you're dealing with a diagnosis of exclusion, it takes a while to actually come to that diagnosis.
It's like checking things off the checklist, mm-hmm. and you rule one thing out, rule another thing out, and eventually get there.
Yes, and it's frustrating for the patient, and it's frustrating for the physician trying to make this patient feel better. The best way to treat it really is to use what's called a Mirena IUD that releases progesterone, and that can thin the lining of the uterus, but it can also help decrease some of that congestion.
Very good. We have Dr. Ian Foley here with us. And in our final minutes, the time has flown. Thank you for some wonderful calls here today and some thought-provoking conversation with Dr. Ian Foley. Where would you like to see us be in the next 5, 10, 15 years as far as women's reproductive health? What advancements would you like to see?
Well, I do enjoy surgery, but certainly when you do surgery, there are risks that are attached with it. So to be able to further advance the minimally invasive surgeries that we can do to minimize both pain and shorten recovery time and improve outcomes. And that, I think that's the next frontier. And certainly pelvic pain can be a very difficult thing to manage and to go through and to better our understanding of endometriosis and better treatment for those diseases, I would be thrilled to be a part of.
We've touched briefly upon this, but when we were talking about trying to be as healthy as possible for a pregnancy, but I would imagine lifestyle, diet, do those affect the reproductive system pretty well?
Well, yeah, women who are overweight, it certainly does impact their ability to ovulate, and women who don't ovulate tend to have heavier bleeding and tend to have more irregular periods, which then causes more issues in their personal life. So yes, weight loss is central to everyone's good health, and being active and exercising is also an invaluable part of a healthy lifestyle.
Dr. Foley, thank you for taking some time here with us today.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Very good conversation here. Dr. Ian Foley from OBGYN Associates in Fairfield. They're at CincyOBGYN.com. That's Cincy with a Y. 513-221-3800. A big thank you going out to Jen Garcia and Deb Teitelbaum with UC Health. And again, Dr. Foley does some of his surgeries at UC Westchester, uchealth.com/Westchester Hospital. If you want to find out about any of the UC Health doctors, 513-298-DOCS. Thank you again to Dr. Ian Foley for being here today on WMKV and WLHS and HealthScope. You've been listening to WMKV Health Scope. Join us again next Monday at 1 p.m. for another edition of WMKV Health Scope on 89.3 WMKV Reading, Ohio.